Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of India's the Truth. Back with us is Patrick Henningsen. He is an independent journalist. What's the gray zone? That's right. Was it the gray zone?
Me? No.
No. 21st Century Wire. Whoa,
yeah.
I'm getting things mixed up. Yeah, it's
But
it's the heat of the day.
Yeah, I'm flattered. No, we've actually been around longer than the gray zone. We've been going since 2009. People-powered, 100% people-powered independent media platform. Yeah.
Hello, dear friends. Just want to remind you, if you like this video or you like what you hear, click like, subscribe if you haven't subscribed yet. Send it to your friends. Let's grow this channel. Maybe we can finally hit it up to 100,000. That would be a good round number for the summer. So let me know. Leave some comments and give a thumbs up. So look forward to seeing you in the next video. Cheers.
Right then. Where does one relocate properly? Desert? 40 degrees? No water? Forests? Rivers? Four seasons? Desert? 40 degrees? No water? Forests? Rivers? Four seasons?
It's actually much simpler than most people think.
Good Lord, that's less paperwork than a gym membership.
As a British man, I chose the place where I can still complain about the weather properly.
All right, let's head that way. Sounds good, I'm ready.
Move to Russia. Start a new life. It's easier with Moscow Connect. Website for details, moscowconnect.ru.
Sorry for didn't mean to.
That's all right.
No insult. last time when we finished up, we started talking about the syndicate, otherwise known as the White House. Now, since that happened, you know, Thomas Massie's lost the lost his race. Marjorie Taylor Greene's out. We've got Rand Paul left. Anybody else in the Republican Party that's not owned by Israel?
That's really difficult. I mean, I'd want to say, obviously, yes, Rand Paul is somewhat of a constitutional conservative.
Right.
But outside of that, Thomas Massie, I mean, the Israel lobby ejected all the other potential. Matt Gaetz would have been one of them.
Mm-hmm.
But they managed to get rid of him. Before Trump's term started by tricking him to think he was going to get an attorney general position, vacated his seat, Pam Bondi moves in, cover up the Epstein files, job done. So they killed three birds with one stone there. That was a slick.
Well, Blanche also said, you know, when Trump was painting pictures of him being Jesus and attacking the pontiff, quietly on the side, there was a couple of interviews who said, we don't see any criminal activity in the file. We've given you all the files, which is a lie right off the bat. And we don't see any criminal activity. No, we're not going to prosecute anyone.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but no, there's not a lot there. You know, the problem with Thomas Massie is, although he could get a groundswell of populist support, I mean, he definitely will get mm-hmm. remnants of MAGA, Bernie Sanders types. They'll gravitate towards him because he's known as being a not only a person of integrity, not only a constitutionalist, a civil liberties advocate, free speech advocate. He's against the Israeli lobby buying off all of our politicians. He's anti-war. These are all very popular mainline, like U.S. middle America positions. And the fact that he's been attacked and unseated with this huge effort, like monetarily, and all the smear campaigns against him, his wife, is just disgusting. Trump calling him the worst congressman in the history of Donald Trump can't even name you 10 congresspeople that sat before he came into government. I mean, he's that thick. Who is he to lecture, put Thomas Massie in a historical context? Kind of ridiculous, but it shows you kind of what you're dealing with there. So, but generally, Congress people don't run for president, not successfully anyway. It's very rare. If it's ever happened, I'm sure maybe it has once or twice, but it's not your conventional path. The conventional path from office is normally senator or governor.
Mm-hmm.
So, but Having said that, Trump kind of broke the mold on, you know, resumes, for political resumes for presidency. But he was also a reality TV star for a couple of decades, effectively, and a public persona. So he'd already won over his base through television. It's kind of like there's not Trump and Zelensky have a lot in common.
I was about to say, it's kind of like Zelensky.
Yeah, he does. You know, I wouldn't have made that comparison before. But they're both very similar in that they held out this fake false advertising that they were there to clamp down on corruption and the oligarchs and all of this stuff. And both of them have presided over what can only be described as an unmitigated disaster for both of their respective countries, both absolute grifters surrounded by charlatans and opportunists and crooks and criminals. They're both TV personas who are acting or masquerading as a chief executive when in fact they have very little, if any, power. And what executive power they do exert, it's usually very, very misplaced and very sort of buckshot. You know, not very precise, and they're both economically illiterate. I'm telling you, Trump is economically illiterate. I didn't want to get into that when he was campaigning. A lot of people have these lawsuits about Trump University, and I just wrote it off as lawfare at the time because they're doing everything to take Trump out for 10 years. And actually looking back at his business portfolio, he hasn't really done anything other than property, which is really an organized crime.
Right.
It's interfacing with various organized crime and so forth, and Teamsters and corrupt city planners, this sort of thing, not paying your suppliers, which Trump is famous for. But the rest was just licensing out his image.
Yeah.
Licensing out his name. That's all he did. He's not produced anything, building golf course, Doral golf courses in, Dubai. That's not some special skill set. You know, anybody can do it. There's no shortages of people. It's just whoever can get to the right officials quick enough and pay them off fast enough gets the opportunity. That's property. It's, you got to get there first. This is property. But in terms of like business and employees and keeping employees happy, he seems very vindictive. He likes to kick people on the way out the door. After he pumps them up, then he'll destroy them and then kick them while they're down and out the door. Like this is not the person you want to be working for. Because if you're not a total sycophant, and then he'll destroy you. But if you're surrounded by sycophants, your company's not going to do very well. And I think government's the same. And this is the problem. He's surrounded by absolute degenerates, like, for instance, Stephen Miller, who was the head of America First Legal. That was like this sort of shell organization that was kind of cocooning MAGA. And Stephen Miller doesn't even have a law degree, as far as I could see. I mean, I can go back and double check, but I did not see him like passing law school. So that's kind of a funny person to have as the sort of legal front. Doesn't have a law degree. I mean, not particularly intelligent, a bit of an ignoramus, but a nepotistic pick by the Israeli lobby. He's wiggled his way in there. It reminds me, Stas, of, I don't know if you've ever had the pleasure of providing security or with the Gulf entourage, you know, like Saudi princes. Okay. They're surrounded by, and I speak from some personal experience, they're surrounded by absolute hangers-on. They've got somebody as a fixer for everything, and they travel with this giant entourage that are basically half of them are fixers. And like every single country and market, they've got a different entourage fixing various things. And but that's kind of what Trump is like. And that's why he kind of loves that golf world, you know, because that is in a way his natural environment. Who do I pay off? You know, who do I grease? You know, yep. He knows how to, he's perfect in that environment. He's very comfortable there, as a matter of fact. But that's Trump world. This is Trump world.
Well, that's, I mean, if you're looking at the Republican Party, I mean, the Democrats are a bit better, not by much. But if you look at the definition of, foreign agent, or an entity representing a foreign government, Maybe the Republican Party should be forced to register as a foreign agent at this point.
Look, just the business associations with Donald Trump Jr., the family, golf aside, Kushner, that grift aside, the Israeli, the ensconced Israeli mesh of relationships and dual memberships and overlap is just quite amazing, actually. The quote Trump made just recently, and I think it was in the last couple of days, he said, "I'm 99% in Israel. I'm polling at 99%.
Yeah,
they love me.
I saw that.
They love me in Israel. When I'm done with this, I'm going to go over there and I can be prime minister." Yep. I'm like, great. Good job, Donald. You know, like, you're doing like 99% over there. And what are you doing at home? You're about 35%. Say, good job, Donald. You really know how to really, I mean, so I'm sure Netanyahu's not going to be very happy about that clip. That's not, and then at the beginning of that clip, he said, "Oh, Bibi's, he'll do what I tell him to do." And he said, but he's being very badly treated by the courts and everybody in Israel. So he took a jibe at Netanyahu there. And then he quickly realizes in Trump's mind is an interesting place. You know, there's an interesting world in his head. And then he probably caught himself on the fly, because everything he does is on the fly.
Right.
He doesn't even know what he says half the time. And he realized, oh, shit, pardon my French. I've just thrown Netanyahu under the bus. I better quickly correct that and say he's been badly treated by the people of Israel. He's doing a great job. So he I mean, it's just so amazing. But he reveals so much through his extemporaneous dialogues. You know, like,
well, you're dealing with an absolute narcissist. An egotistical narcissist. Well, I guess egotistical narcissist pretty much is the same thing in this case. But, this is not a very well-educated one at that.
No, he's not very ignorant. I mean, look, I don't know what to say. I'll get accused of having Trump derangement syndrome. I've given up. The bot's already programmed to respond to me like that. TDS, TDS. But he's functionally illiterate.
Yeah.
Trump is a functional illiterate. He knows how to read probably the heading of a contract, the title of a bill, the headline of an article, but he will not read the article. He will not read the small print. He'll sign. Where do I sign? I sign here. And that's all he needs to know. And he's got people around him telling him things, and he watches TV, and he sort of synthesizes all that in his head. But he doesn't read anything. He doesn't really understand anything. He's not concerned about the names of world leaders that he's dealing directly with. Mm-hmm. I've seen him forget the names, or like maybe grasping onto their first name, but not knowing their second name. He does this quite frequently. He really doesn't know who he's dealing with. He just knows that's a guy. He's a Pakistani, and he's a good guy, or he's a bad guy, or he's all right. I'm not sure. I think they told me he was all right. And it's Ahmed, whatever. That's it. Like General Ahmed. But meanwhile, the guy's got a title, and he's probably president of Pakistan. Doesn't matter to Trump in his world. It just doesn't matter. So he doesn't read anything, doesn't know any history. And he constantly makes these pronouncements and statements about U.S. history and where he fits within U.S. history in the procession of leaders, presidents, achievements, etc. And no one's seen anything like this before. I think I'm the first. They say I'm the first to do this. Many have tried. No one's done anything like this ever before, you know, kind of thing. He's constantly... It's the strangest, most disconcerting, and it's the most banal thing. There's something about his delivery that's very banal. It just kind of he's ground the public down to the point where it's just this. I think Hannah Arendt called it the banality of evil. Like the real evil, when you get down to it, it's just completely. You know, banal, and just the vapidity of it is just, That's the real evil. I think Trump really embodies that more than ever.
Well, I mean, if you look at the statistics from last year, 21% of the American population, not immigrants, American adult population is functionally illiterate. Yeah, that's first to third grade. Third grade in the U.S. is like first grade in Russia. And another 30, and the worst part of it is 32% are semi-literate. They read between third grade and sixth grade in the U.S. It's like first to third grade in Russia. So you got half the population that reads at, you know, it, well, I guess they could read Brady Bunch book or something like that, you know. I mean, something for a fourth grader or lower, and basically one-fifth of the population, more than one-fifth of the population, really can't read even that. They barely could read comics at the end of a newspaper. So I guess if you're talking to a population that's that dumbed down, they don't know history. They like you, you're their guy, they'll believe whatever you tell them. They're not going to go pick up a book and check the, well, let's see, how many presidents have done this or who in the world history has done that. They'll just believe whatever they're told.
He reflects the American trend. Mm-hmm. Trump is the America. He is a very, in many ways, a very accurate reflection of American society in this day and age. And the crazy thing is, at his level right now of power, that he cannot be compelled by anybody to actually read anything or know anything. He would push back, sack them, threaten them. Mr. President, you've got to know this. And he's like, okay, yeah, well, tell me what I need to know. And put it in the teleprompter. Put it on the notes. You know, put it in my earpiece, whatever. I don't think he really feels like he needs to know a lot of things, like, you know, geography, history, names, international relations, diplomacy. It's Pol Pot year zero, but like the Don Rowe version of Pol Pot, you know. It's just, we don't need anything that happened before this. This is the best that it's ever going to get. I'm the best, and we're starting from scratch right now, and we're going to do it my way, you know, kind of thing. Like Pol Pot, you know. Same methods.
This reminds me, I knew this one warrant officer when I was serving, and he had been serving in the UAE. He was sent in the UAE to help the UAE accommodate new equipment that they bought from the U.S. So he was in this one general staff, and the general was a UAE general, a sheikh. You know, that's how you become a general. He said, you know, the guy was illiterate. He couldn't read and write. He couldn't count. He couldn't. And his point was, why do I need to? I have slaves that can do that for me. I mean, in our societies, the moment you get enough money, you want to send your kid, if you don't have the higher education, at least your kids will have the higher education. You find money, you send your kids to get educated. In their society, it's why? I'll buy a slave or hire a slave that can do it for me. And they take pride in that. So this sounds a lot like that.
It's not a drawback in that world. It's a virtue, actually. I don't need to know. And you know, it's so funny. Not to digress, but there are a lot of people in the Gulf at those levels, at tops of institutions, connected through family, sheikdom, whatever the lines of succession. It's like Saudi is the land of 6,000 princes. I don't know how many princes there are. There's a lot of princes. And have a you go into their office and fantastic degrees on the wall. I mean, it's like, wow, you know, that's Harvard. And there's like, okay, yeah, that's a top school there. Uh-huh. Georgia Tech, Texas A&M, UCLA, and all these liberal arts colleges. And they're like, but they can't really, they can't write a paragraph. They need to have a Westerner to do that for them. So a lot of the times the family had made a generous donation to the university and built a lab or a building. I mean, isn't that how Jared Kushner got into Harvard?
But at least
Jared just like that
knows how to read and write, I think.
Yeah, so he's no different, really. That's why Kushner does so well in the Gulf. It's just so superficial and so shallow. That's Kushner's natural environment. That's why he went over there. No problem with having the brass to walk up there and like ask for a couple hundred billion to put in our fund, which he was going to then launder through Israel, which is a genius, actually. Got all the Saudis' hands dirty. It's almost they blackmailed them in front of the Arab world with the Abraham Accords, not realizing that they'd put money in a fund that was channeling right through Israel. And there's no turning back at that point, right?
Well, look at the UAE. Oh, it turns out you're Israel's mistress. Okay. Oh, we didn't really want you to know that, but I guess that cat's out of the bag. Whoops. Netanyahu visits you personally while you're attacking Iran.
Yeah, I mean, that's. I don't know if you've had any experience in that part of the world, Stas, but I could say a thing or two about that.
I've had a little bit of experience. Well, for example, in the military, you know when you do officer exchanges, in the U.S. military, foreign officers cannot fail any course. That's because of the Arabs, the Gulf Arabs. Normally, you know, when countries send officers or cadets, what have you, on any of these courses, they send their best people to represent them, right? That's the face of your country. With these guys, it's the proper son of the proper sheikh that goes. Doesn't matter. He's fat, stupid, goofy, can't read and write. Does not matter. We had, and I've seen a lot of these guys. We had one in my course when I was doing officer basic, when I was a lieutenant, Jordanian guy. And he would sit out flat. His sponsor was writing, and the sponsor was a smart guy. And in the middle of the exams, he just sit there and copy them. He didn't try to hide it and sneak it. He didn't give a damn. You can't fire me. And what I was told, the reason, because I wound up, you know, why can't we fail? Why can't these guys get failed? It's like, it's a DOD prerogative. You cannot fail them. And what happened was, apparently, back in the 80s, they did fail them. And a couple of these guys, you know, they came back. There was a Saudi, and I think there was an Egyptian. They didn't make it off the tarmac before they had their heads chopped off, put in a box, and sent back as an apology. And the DOD was like, whoa, we don't need this. You know, but they didn't want to single out the Arabs, so just said across the board, nobody can fail. But everybody still sends their best, except for, you know, the Arabic guys that I've seen. They were, you know, and I've seen that in business, too. And, you know, the other experience like that I had was we were bidding on a contract, me and two partners. And one of them was a Jordanian Arab, but he was an Orthodox Christian. He was living in Houston. And we were bidding on a contract to build a hospital in Jordan. And, you know, and it popped up that apparently it had gone through at this point. And one of my partners was a Russian guy. He had a construction company. This is 20 years ago. It turned out that we found out inadvertently that the British and the Germans had said no, we're not gonna. They quit even bidding, and then we found out why. Because as you're bidding, as you're trying to work out through the problem and the issue, you start to figure out that the people you're constantly talking to are just middlemen, and then the next layer of middlemen, and the next layer of middlemen, and after 3 months, we couldn't get to the decision makers. It's just more middlemen, and they all want to share. And you start looking at it, it's like, there's no point in doing this. We're just going to lose money because by the time you feed all these hands that are stuck out, give me my share. I pass you to the next middleman. He needs a share. It's like, this is pointless. This is absolutely pointless. After 3 months, we can't get to a decision maker. They were like, why don't you fly over here? Because they didn't think we would. And they were finally like, look, we're going to go buy tickets to fly. Oh, no, wait. We need to figure things out. You know, it's like, okay, got it. This is endless. This is pointless. This is endless. And I understand why the British and the Germans quit this whole game. So we'll be quitting too now. But yeah, it's those are my personal experiences.
I was quite shocked, you know, having seen how Dubai was developed and Abu Dhabi as well over the years, and just it just exploded. And the amount of Western DFI that came in there, Western capital, Western businesses, brands, companies, you know, you name it, everybody was moving in there. And I thought, wow, initially I was impressed because I'm like, wow, this is a forward thinking Gulf Arab state here, life beyond oil. Well, if we can bring in the capital and we can make this a financial hub and get people spending here and generating all kinds of revenue streams, I thought, wow, good on you. That's pretty impressive. Pretty impressive feat. They made a huge mistake, though. They let the Israelis in. And I can't tell you what an absolute disaster that is, because little by little, all of a sudden, your tech sector is taken over. All of a sudden, your military, your government's using their apps. You're working with their consultants. Your military is now suddenly enmeshed. All of a sudden, they have intelligence presence in your country. Next thing you know, they're going to be running Vice on the side with their people and import, export, you name it. I think in 10 years, that will just be a hollowed out shell of an emirate. The Muslims will live in Sharjah or whatever. There's no guarantee that will be safe. But, or they'll be in various enclaves. By the time the Israelis get done, do you think the Israelis will say, we're not going to want to take your oil and gas? Oh. I mean, do you really think that the Israelis would be hands off? No, you can have that yourself. We just want to be here to, like, you know, facilitate. I think 10 years, you'll have... I predict if they continue on the current trajectory, the royal family in the UAE, mark my words, will be as vestigial and symbolic as the royal family in Britain, literally the figureheads for the Arab world. And it'll be absolutely run by Israelis and Americans, full stop. So and nothing else. And they'll have hollowed out and taken over and basically run all sorts of businesses, and they'll keep the slave labor because that works.
Yeah.
That works. All the Sri Lankans, the Bengalis, the Indians, and the Nepalese, that's the new one, is from Nepal. Hmm. All the labor is coming from Nepal and the Philippines, of course. Yeah,
the Philippines.
But
also.
That's going to become an Israeli colony. That's effectively, you've given them the keys to the back door of everything in your country. That can only end in tears. And yeah, that's what I think if they continue.
Well, the Israelis are now buying up property all over southern Cyprus. And they're locking the Greeks out, the way that they are the native population. And they also made a demand that the Greeks start rent to own Aegean islands to them. Oh, right. Yeah. These people, they don't have any kind of
rent.
Rent us out these islands and we'll eventually buy them from you.
Settlements. Like, it'll be settlements. Yeah, settlements in Greece. I mean, why not? It's just, they have a lot of faith in the Holy Land, clearly.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, there's 300,000 are going to be building a new colony in Argentina.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, what are they hedging for there? I can't imagine. Are they down in southern Argentina? Are they Bariloche?
They are. There was a law that was passed that any damaged natural reserves or fire damage could be sold to foreigners. And then there's a lot of videos coming out of people setting fire to the
That was a big controversy before. Yeah.
And now apparently they're going to have a 300,000 man colony there.
I think it's in the south. And, you know, coincidentally, Bariloche and these areas were settled by another wave of immigrants after the Second World War. The ones that had, with the pink swastikas on their socks, those guys, they went down there the same place. It's so funny how history rhymes.
It is, isn't it? The first time history rhymes. Well, the first time history repeats is a tragedy. The second time, it's a farce. It's amazing. It's absolutely amazing to watch this, the way it's unfolding. But and then again, you know, we'd started talking about the Trump crime syndicate. And people go, oh, derangement syndrome. Yeah, but, you know, when you steal Venezuelan oil using the U.S. military, half of it's supposed to go back to Venezuela somehow or other, but, you know, in theory anyways. And the rest goes to an offshore, non-transparent slush fund?
Yeah. Yep.
How does that work again?
Well, remember when they were explaining this, when Rubio was saying, no, we're going to take their oil and then sell it at market value. I remember right. very clearly that was the sales pitch. But, you know, the way he explained it was like, well, we're going to sell it for them.
Yeah.
And then, you know, give them all the money. And I'm thinking to myself, because in order for them to help the Venezuelan people, I said, why didn't you just lift sanctions then? You know, let them sell it on the market at market value. Like, what's the difference? So they weren't being straight. And there is a lot of theft and embezzlement going on to selected people who are given opportunities, not just no bid contracts, but like opportunities to be involved in handling, facilitating certain things. The reason Trump is absolutely livid about the Straits of Hormuz is when he really started going postal on that was when Iran started charging.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's when Trump, that's when his alarm goes off. So, 'cause he's like, I want that money.
Oh yeah.
They're like daily metered traffic through I want that money.
Yeah.
Like, how dare they? That's ours. You know, that's our money. That's the mentality.
What's yours is also.
That's the mentality, yeah. You know. That's what he was really upset about. And so and of course, whatever his Israeli coterie is, they would want to position themselves either or his sons or Jared or whoever would cough through, and they will stablecoin it. They'll yep. stablecoin it. And that's exactly, and they're just thinking, wow, you know, this is, wow, we could really, really use this one right now. You know, that'll just set us up for another 100 years. But that's how these people are thinking. What the Cuba thing is just, quite frankly, disgusting on a level that it's very hard to even articulate. Venezuela was bad, but this idea that Cuba needs to be punished and we're going to bring freedom and love and democracy to them after we've been punishing them with a brutal embargo. Cuba's done nothing to the U.S. And if you're still grinding the axe of the Batista regime and the collectivization programs that came in with Castro, that was 70 years ago.
Well, how much of that is being run by our little friend there, Marco Rubio?
Well, yeah, he does have feel like he's got his little stake here. He sees himself as, you know, like he is like he's got two job titles right now, National Security Advisor and Secretary of State. Right, his third job is campaigning for 2028 for president. That's his third job. Footman to the Israeli lobby. There's a fourth job. Fifth job, Viceroy of Venezuela, unofficially. And sixth job is Viceroy of Cuba, the Free Republic of Cuba, presided over by Viceroy Marco Rubio.
Well, you know, a lot of people don't know this about Marco Rubio, but the roots of his family, and he mentioned it in his speech in Spain, his family comes from that middling aristocracy in the Spanish Empire that was used actually as viceroys in the different colonies. So his ancestors were viceroys over Cuba and other areas. And he even says that, you know, they'd be shocked if they knew that the offspring of his so-and-so clan has returned and is now, you know, reading this lecture to the Spanish government and all that. And I think in his mind, you know, that's his aim. He wants to be, he quite literally wants to be the viceroy of these territories. Basically the local undisputed ruler in somebody else's name, but still the local undisputed.
And he's very friendly with the Noboa family in Ecuador and implicated in the massive cocaine trafficking into Europe and hidden in Noboa banana fruit packages, the Noboa fruit company, I think it's called, and then also tangential to another big cocaine trafficker, Juan Orlando Hernandez, who now we found out recently that Israel, for some reason, was very, very interested in lifting his, getting him pardoned, and they put the pressure on Trump. Probably Rubio was involved in that as well, because you're talking about Israel, you're talking about Rubio. You know, we're talking about Paul Singer. Paul Singer got a nice little spiv off of the pain and suffering of this of the Venezuelan people by hoovering up the distressed assets of the Citco, what the remains of Citco, the Venezuelan State Petroleum Company, after the United States through sanctioning managed to bankrupt their foreign subsidiaries, and then Paul Singer comes in, the billion, and then to get paid back from his lousy assets, the payoff was the U.S. invading and taking over Venezuela and taking control of the oil, and he positioned himself to profit off that as well. So, yeah, that's how business is going right now.
But do you think Venezuela is over? I mean, look, we understand Rodriguez sold out, but then again, there's a lot of people around Rodriguez that aren't exactly happy with that. Then there's Machada and her crew that just got tossed under the bus, even after she gave her Nobel Peace Prize. She didn't earn it anyways, but at least she didn't give away the $1 million portion of it to Trump.
She gave it to Trump. I mean, stupidest thing. And so,
I mean, talk about groveling at that point. God, that's got to go. She needs a separate prize for groveling. And then she gets tossed. She gets tossed under the bus.
Yeah. It's really bad. I don't know the extent. Craig Murray might know more than anybody, but I don't know the extent to which Delcy Rodriguez, the vice president, quote, sold out. I'm sure it was much more complicated than that sort of straightforward assessment, because that place would be crawling with CIA operatives for decades. So I'm sure they had 100 different ways to triangulate the people in power there. But I will say that I can say it's what normally happens with these U.S. operations is they don't deliver anything after the fact. In fact, the economy will generally get worse. Wealth gap will generally increase. There'll be more corruption and pilfering. And then that's only going to embolden the Chavista movement and all the grassroots movements, and young socialists will catch on to the messaging of their elders, as it were. And these things tend to revitalize like things like the Chavista movement. So I think, and that's, they can't stop, you can't stop popular movements, especially when it's very clear that what was promised, you got the opposite. I mean, look at the United States. I mean, even a country that's so like anodyne and totally cucked like America, the American political system, that they're even, they will and perhaps could threaten to overturn the fake populist revolution of MAGA with a counter revolution that's probably more more sort of tethered to reality, you could say, and the economy is a big part of that. Trump didn't deliver. Yeah. Same with Venezuela. I can't see how they're gonna deliver. You know, the problem is, even with sanctions, what happens is, and this is the thing about Venezuela. Listen. The economic, the financial department in the government of Nicolas Maduro, they took a situation of hyperinflation that was one of the worst in history. Literally, you could just burn the money. It was just spiraling out of control. Spend your paycheck by, if you got it on Friday, spend it on before Monday. Otherwise, it's going to be worthless.
Right.
So they turned that around to the point where they almost got, they got inflation down to under 10% a year at one point. Anybody that does that after being the target of economic warfare, where everything's in free fall for like 2 years, like 400, 500% inflation, to rein that in, to get it under and stable, like they deserve some kind of major award and all gold medals in like for a Nobel Prize in economics, while they're under sanctions, while they're under embargo. I mean, so that's not an incompetent government. In my opinion, that's a very competent government. And so the U.S. was probably incensed by their comeback story in Venezuela. That's why they went in hard and heavy to take out Maduro. And they'll say, oh, Maduro was corrupt. He threw the last election. Well, you say he threw the last election. According to who? Venezuelan NGOs in New York City?
Yeah.
In Miami? Like, really show us the receipts. How did he steal the election, the last election. So that's never been made clear. The other thing is, and I don't want to get off on too much of a tangent, but when your country is under attack of subterfuge by NGOs, Soros, USAID, CIA, NED, plus the external manipulation of your economy, your currency, and you've got literally spooks running around everywhere in your country and causing literal riots at the border with Colombia a couple of years ago, and literally trying to destabilize your country.
Right.
If the government puts a heavy hand down at some point during elections, so what? It's within their purview to do a certain amount of that, because you're talking about stability, national stability, and stability for any government comes first. And you can audit it, you can criticize this, oh, that wasn't done right, oh, they broke procedure there, fine. But, you know, if you're in charge and you're running things, you can't just let it all go to pot, because people can die and get killed and a lot of harm can be done. So that's what the Venezuelan government did, as far as my study of that situation.
The one thing I can say that they did badly, in my opinion, is they used a lot of the money out of the oil and gas industry for the social projects, because that's why the oil and gas industry went down, because there was enough money. But on the flip side, the U.S. also banned exporting any equipment. But the real question, though, is why did they leave their reserves in the U.S.?
You know what? It's a good question. Why did they leave their gold reserves in the U.K.?
Yeah.
Because they were promised at the time. See, things have been done that nobody could have foreseen, like the abrogation of international law, the piracy, the theft. A lot of 20 years ago, it is like there was this, no matter how bad it was, that people were still going to play good cricket on certain things. and so they probably got nice return leasing their gold out to a New York bank, getting a nice little return. It's literally money for nothing. The only problem is what happens when you ask for it back.
Yeah. The Germans found out what happens when they ask for your money back. Did Merkel ever get her whole reserves back?
I don't know.
I don't think she did.
that's another one. Yeah. So, so Venezuela, same sort of boat. They're in there. That story's not over. I don't think it is.
I don't think it is. Let's see. When was the last time there was a full audit of Fort Knox? I think it was 1956, somewhere around there, 1958. I mean, physical, not just counting, but actually drilling, taking core samples to make sure it's actual gold all the way through, things like that. I think that was just done once in like 1958, and everybody just trusts.
Yeah. Yep. It's interesting. Russia shipped quite a bit of gold. They've exported quite a bit of gold in the last couple of 6 months or so. Someone might look at it like, oh, that's crisis management or they're in trouble. But actually, no, Russia's been steadily accumulating gold for the last 10 years and strategically. And so is China. And that's what it's for. You've got it. You use it to get things like foreign currency, or you use it to rebalance your books if your economy looks like it's a little bit on the shake. And Russia's quite adept at this. They've absolutely proven their mettle financially since 2000. I would say since 2013, Russia has shown at every single turn that they're able to engineer stability with their economy. They've been able to balance out their domestic payments, their other obligations. And, you know, Christine Lagarde was like completely blown away by the skill of the Russian economists and Putin's finance. You could see it at the St. Petersburg Economic Forum. She's just like, almost like in awe of the financial jurisprudence of Russia. She could see, as a banker, as a major central banker, she respected them, and that says a lot.
The Russian government, there's some that's flown under the radar in the West, but the Russian government opened a market for gold St. Petersburg stock market, strictly for physical gold, no paper on gold. And you had to bring that physical gold in. It goes into a holding bank, and within 24 hours, the purchaser gets his physical gold. And that came in last November. And I mean, gold right now is down because everybody's needing liquidity, thanks to Uncle Trump. But gold started going up because, you know, this is actual physical gold, and City of London and Wall Street have no control over, you know, making, it's absolute transparent. It's price fixing at the market level. You can see how that price is, well, not price fixing, price discovery. That's the proper word. Meanwhile, you got price fixing in the West because, you know, everybody knows gold is well below its market value. Yeah. So I don't know how they respond to that one.
Yeah, I mean, the per capita, Russia and China have acquired the most in gold reserves in the last 10, 15 mm-hmm. years. And so there's a lot of, and the gold that Russia is passing to China right now, it's still staying within the BRICS world. Yep. So you just have this more bigger accumulation of gold reserves between BRICS countries, between Russia and China. And so, yeah, they're in a very, very strong position to back some kind of an international SDR or a currency that's backed by a basket of commodities, including gold, but not exclusively. But that's a big one. If you want to talk about anchoring the trust in your money or financial system or the value of your currency, and you've got decent gold reserves, and you've got oil, and you've got other minerals, let's say, it's the ideal basket of currency. So you have the resource workhouse of the world, which is the Russian Federation. You have the manufacturing workhouse, which is China. So that creates a nice anchor for that sort of BRICS Global South constellation of, let's say, you know, where the money is shifting right now, where business is shifting, where political power is shifting.
Don't forget, though, and people forget this, Russia has the fourth largest manufacturing base in the world, too. It's a lot smaller in China, but, you know, it's somewhere between the U.S. and India. On the side, Russia has a very large, and I spent a lot of time in heavy manufacturing, heavy equipment, and of course, because, you know, oil, gas, services, supply chain side, and I watched a lot of these businesses go from total wrecks to looking brand new. You know, massive investments, upgrades, new companies opening up. So there's a large manufacturing base there.
Yeah, Russia's also very, people don't know, Russia's very strong in construction and building and engineering. I mean, they're the best in, among the best in the world, undoubtedly.
Kerch Bridge. How many people said that thing would never exist? You can't build a bridge there. Or
oh, that one.
Bridge.
Yeah, you know, yeah.
It's all CGI. I've been down on that bridge. It's not CGI.
But did they not build that in record time?
Yeah.
I mean, even from a Chinese workflow standpoint, it was quick.
And it's actually two bridges. Because you have the automobile bridge, and parallel you have a rail line.
That's right.
That's actually a separate bridge, separate platform, a bit lower going down the whole length.
And it's been attacked with direct military strikes. And to my knowledge, it recovered. They managed to repair it very quickly.
It's 16 kilometers. I mean, you can't blow the whole thing up. I mean, I guess you could, but it's going to take quite a bit of effort. If you blow any one small section up, it takes about a month to repair it, bring it in. So, yeah, they did. The Ukrainians did it twice. They did it with a truck bomb, and apparently that truck driver had no clue what he was driving across it. The second time it was, a drone took it out from underneath. But again, they blew up one arch. Part of the bridge is closed, and they still had traffic going in the other lanes, and then they had to replace that portion.
Yeah, that isthmus and the peninsula, not on the Crimean side, but on the Russian side, that's where some of the best red wine in the world is made, by the way.
Yep.
It's among the best in the world. There's a few famous places there. That area is great agricultural land.
an interesting thing. Before 2022, the Italians were actually buying a lot of the grape material from Russia for their wines. It's not something they advertised very often. If you looked in the right place, you'd pop up, you'd see exports to Italy, grape material, things like that, wine materials. But yeah, they were doing that. So
yeah, Abkhazia, that whole area, it's absolutely perfect growing conditions. Georgia, obviously, Georgia has this long and storied great agricultural and vineyard history.
Oh yeah,
as well.
By Georgian legend, that's all the wine came from Georgia. That was the original place for wine. I don't know how much I trust that, but you know.
In the Bible, yeah, probably in the Bible, yeah, all the way back to biblical times.
God promised us wine here. That's why we got wine. Yeah. But yeah, that's true. That's very true. And they underestimate all of it on a constant basis. Don't really hear much about it in the West.
Yeah.
Just ignore it.
So, you know,
go away.
Those are things to fall back on because, you know, infrastructure, engineering, construction, internal industries, commodities, resources. And so no matter what's happening with the fluctuations of the tumultuous global overly leveraged financialized economy, those fundamentals are very much solidly in place. And it means that those countries that have those can weather the storm. Iran's one of those.
Yep.
Iran's one of those. China can weather the storm just by the sheer nature of their economic prowess and their massive capabilities on every front. Russia, of course, from a resource point of view, you know, oil crisis, energy crisis. It's not going to be a domestic crisis for them per se.
Gasoline or petrol has gone up about 7 rubles. 6 rubles.
And that's a crisis.
Yeah. Well, we produce most of it.
There's Russians complaining about that right now. Rubles. Yeah. It's outrageous.
Of course. You know, and that's one of those little interesting points because quite literally the country can block itself off from the rest of the world. And it may not have all the high tech that it needs, but it can survive. It can feed itself and it can continue prospering, continue building. It's got basically everything it needs.
The U.S., that's the U.S., that's behind the kind of Fortress USA grand strategy thought, is that the U.S. can pull its drawbridges up, the whole world can go to hell in a handbasket, and they'll just, like, show up to sweep up the ashes afterwards. But the difference between the U.S. and Russia is Russia's attached to the European continent, and the whole of Asia, so they're always going to have a viable export trade, no matter what. So aside from the domestic economy and situation, they have constant viable clients for export. And the United States, if they make enemies with the entire world and decide to invade, attack, strangle, abuse, pillage and plunder everybody, including everybody in the Western Hemisphere, they might find problems at some point with their external trade. And I think Trump's kind of shown with the tariff wars how some of these ill-conceived ideas of, you know, U.S. hegemony can backfire badly. Right. Yeah.
Yeah, because, you know, Belt and Road Initiative, its a whole job is to avoid the U.S. Navy. You know, go around it. But what has the U.S., you know, the U.S., I remember the U.S. came up with lots of different theories of what they're going to, the counter Belt and Road Initiatives and things like that. But at the end of the day, what have they come up with? Well, just cause revolutions in your countries along the way. I mean, other than that, what have they got to offer the world? I'm talking about, you know, you had the American dream. I mean, that's dead. That's obvious to anybody in the U.S. that's dead. So what's your civilizational idea now?
Right. Yeah. What's your compelling future for the world? What are you selling? Right.
Rape and pillage.
I mean, the punishment. all stick, no carrot.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, we'll get your owners rich, and then the rest of you peasants can go die off.
It's not a clear sales pitch right now. That's the problem. People don't understand. You know, that's the source of U.S. power.
Yeah.
It's an idea. It's the perception of being an honest broker. The perception of being a good, resourceful ally. Whether they are honest or whether they are always an ally, that's another argument. But it's that perception. Everything rests on that.
Absolutely.
And when you lose that, you lose your power. That's what I learned studying international relations in history, is that is really that once you lose that level of confidence, then it's just a question of time before everything begins to collapse. And I think they're in that phase now.
You know, Hollywood is actually one of the best weapons the U.S. used to have.
Absolutely.
And Hollywood produced movies that gave you hope. Oh, look how life is great here. Everybody's cool. They're partying. They're living it up. Of course, now Hollywood just produces absolute crap that nobody wants to see, period. It's preachy, annoying, and depressing. But that Hollywood was actually, that hope that they were projecting was actually a very powerful weapon.
I could get into it, but that, you know, the U.S. government funded all the cinemas in France after the war.
Really?
Very pro-U.S. films, and because that was, they believed that was their best shot to balance off the socialist political forces in France after the war. So this has always been a big priority, you know, film and TV and stuff like that. And it is powerful. They started concentrating less on heroes and more on villains in Hollywood and dystopic, not so compelling futures. And that's what, and I think it's now just begun to fold in on itself because it lost that magic that it was exporting, as you rightly say. You know, they went dark, basically. Dark and dystopic.
They have. If you look at the movies in the 60s and the 70s, you know, dark movies, most of them weren't that dark to begin with. But there were a lot more the Jimmy Stewart type movies that people remember. It's like, wow, yeah, I want to live like that. I want to have that house and the Christmas tree and all that. And now it's, you know, I mean, if you just look at the number of movies, are just post-apocalyptic, I think it's like every second one. Zombies, aliens, just
causing society. Yeah, the Earth has been destroyed 100 times over in Hollywood. Are you talking about? But
there was even a joke. It was a Russian joke. Boy's asking his grandpa, "Grandpa, why in the American movies the aliens always attacking America?" It's like, they know where the bad guys live. that's the answer. So it's, but you know, that's just a reflection of society as a whole. So Patrick, I want to thank you. We got a hard stop. I got another call coming up.
Yeah,
I want to thank you for joining. I'd love to continue the conversation.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks, Stas.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you very much, everybody. Thank you. Leave your comments and ask questions. That's the key.